The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Antiochus and the Maccabee Revolt, is the 10th of a 15-part series, From the Exile of the Ten Tribes to the Reign of Herod. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmas Yechiel Mechel Ben Moshe Reuben, Oliver Sholem, Mr. Mechel Ellenberg of blessed memory.
One of the least understood chapters of Jewish history deals with the period surrounding Hanukkah, the events that precede it, and its aftermath. According to the conventional wisdom, the villain of the Hanukkah story is Antiochus. He's generally portrayed as a man obsessed with a vision that his whole empire should accept one religion, that of the Greeks. In our minds, we tend to think of him as an ancient Torquemada, the chief inquisitor of the Spanish Inquisition. Any Jews that were involved, we tend to picture them similar to the collaborators in the time of Nazi Germany, Quisling of Norway, a handful of people who compromised their standards and their values for the enemy. The hero of the Hanukkah story, of course, in people's minds, is Yehuda Maccabee. And he figures in our minds similar to perhaps George Washington, the leader of the American Revolution. He's fighting for pluralism, democracy. I don't remember. This picture sits very well with us. And it's for that reason that even in the most assimilated Jewish homes, you see the Hanukkah lights. It's something that even the most assimilated Jew could identify with. Religious freedom, pluralism. But the story that emerges from the original sources is something which is quite different. And the struggle of Hanukkah would perhaps be more similar to the Civil War in this country, or perhaps the American Revolution with the Tories, the Loyalists, against the revolutionaries. And in fact, as we're going to see, that Antiochus performs an important but yet only secondary role. He's only a supporting actor. And the major players are actually Jews on both sides. As if you turn to the timeline, which is in the back of the outline you're given, what we've covered in Egyptian history in the past weeks, if you notice in the line, Egypt, Ptolemy the First, Ptolemy the Second, and Ptolemy the Third. In the middle or towards the ends of Ptolemy the Third, there rose a new Jewish leader. This is between the years, if you see, on BCE, it would be between the years 246 and 221. That's his reign and the reign of his... In between the Third... Oh, this is a mistake. Okay. Between the Third and the Fourth, there rose a Jewish leader, a new kind of Jewish leader. We knew of kings, we knew of Kohanim Gadolim, high priests. This was a leader of the Jewish mafia. This, as we discussed last week, this is Yosef Ben Tovia. And he was able to secure the monopoly of taxation, that he farmed the taxes, so to speak, that he paid the crown a certain amount of money. He taxed the people over that amount. The difference was his profit. And he became enormously wealthy, of course, at the cost of all those poor people who were terribly squeezed. Our story begins, now I begin to turn the first page, with the son of this Yosef ben Tovia, while Yosef was still alive. How this son was born, by the way, and this is how Josephus relates this, gives us some sort of an insight into what kind of a person this Yosef ben Tovia was. The story, as Josephus relates, was that he fell in love, this Yosef, with a non-Jewish actress. And he wanted to commence having an affair with this woman. Yosef's brother convinced him that he would supply someone else in this non-Jewish actress' stead. And while he was drunk at some sort of a party, this Yosef, the brother dressed up his own daughter. And she feigned the role of a courtesan, of this actress, and he had relations with her. After he had awoken up from his drunken stupor, he asked the brother about her, because it was my daughter. They eventually got married, and they had a son by the name of Hyrcanus. Hyrcanus begins, this is the title of the first name, Hyrcanus. It gives us an idea about Yosef himself, as we're going to see about his son. The son, as Josephus relates, was a brilliant person, and as we're going to read, this is a quote from Antiquities Josephus. A. But when one told him that Ptolemy had a son just born, that told us Yosef, and all the principal men of Syria and the other countries subject to him were to keep a festival on account of the child's birthday, and went away in haste with great retinues to Alexandria, and as all the other people of prestige went down, and of course it was important for him in his position, also to have a representative. And he was himself indeed hindered from going by old age. But he made trial of his sons, or whether any of them would be willing to go to the king. And when the elder sons excused themselves from going and said they were not courtiers good enough for such conversation, and advised him to send their brother Hyrcanus, this was the youngest brother, he gladly hearkened to that advice and called Hyrcanus and asked him whether he would go to the king, whether it was agreeable to him to go or not. And upon his promise that he would go, and his saying that he should not want much money for his journey, because he would live moderately, the 10,000 drachma would be sufficient, he was pleased with his son's prudence. And on that note, Hyrcanus left Yerushalayim and went to Alexandria. Now, in Alexandria, this Yosef had a business office and had a representative by the name of Arion. When Hyrcanus came before Arion, Hyrcanus already had a totally different plan and wanted to really impress the king. His plan was not to take 10,000 drachma, which would be a small fund, but really to have to take 300 talents of gold, a tremendous sum of money, and with it to buy slaves, very educated slaves. There were very different levels of slaves in antiquity. And these were very highly educated, very handsome male and female slaves, and to present them as a present to Ptolemy. This Arion, of course, resisted, and Ptolemy had him thrown into prison. This Hyrcanus had him thrown into prison. After much pressure, this Arion finally agreed with this Hyrcanus request. Josephus tells us after he had got the money and was ready to buy the slaves, he was invited to this party. This was the birthday party. And he was just a young child.
I mean, maybe he was 15 or 16. I mean, he was quite young, and he looked very young. And the people, the others, this is called the principal men of Syria, felt that it was an affront that such a young man should sit on the same table as them. And they decided to play a trick. After they had finished eating, and Hyrcanus ate at the same table, and it would seem that he ate just the food that was served to all of them, which gives us, again, a sense of the religious commitment of this Hyrcanus. The people passed down the bones, what was the leftovers of their meat, down the table, until all the bones formed a large pile in front of Hyrcanus. On that, Trypho, who was the court jester, stood up and made a comment of, look at what a person this Hyrcanus is, what a pile of bones that he's left, and what of a glutton he is. On the spot, Hyrcanus replied, well, of course, I'm not like the other people. You notice none of them have any bones. They swallowed them all. The king enjoyed his wit and his genius, and he was the hit of the party. Just to give us a sense of how they viewed the others and the other people from Syria and Egypt viewed this Hyrcanus' father, this Trypho, and starting when he was making jests of Hyrcanus and all the bones, and you have in paragraph B. So he stood by the king and said, this is Trypho, dost thou not see, my lord, the bones that lie by Hyrcanus? And as that he had taken all, they were just bones. By this similitude, thou mayest conjecture that his father made all Syria bare as he had made all those bones. In other words, it gives us a sense of how they viewed that how much pressure and how he had depleted the reserves of the people that this Yosef had taxed. After the party and they enjoyed Hyrcanus' wit, he presented the 300 slaves. They made a tremendous hit at the party. And in fact, Josephus describes that he, in a sense, won a coup over the others as well, because it wasn't just a question of impressing the king, but to impress the king more than anyone else would impress the king. So before he actually gave the present and gave these slaves, which were of tremendous worth, he went over to each and every one of the other people and said that I'm only able to afford a very small gift. 7,000 drachma, a very small, insignificant gift. And all the other people felt very good that they didn't have to strain themselves to give anything that would really impress the king. And after they had all given their token gifts, Hyrcanus gave this tremendous gift. And in that way, he ingratiated himself to Ptolemy. However, as we know, in families, the father of the business, who created the business, worked hard to make it, is not as liberal throwing out the money as the son, as the heir of the business, who really didn't have to work a stitch to create all this wealth. And here it takes us to paragraph C. And when his brethren heard that Hyrcanus had received such favors from the king and was returning home with great honor, they went out to meet him and to destroy him. It gives us a sense of what kind of people we're dealing with. It gives us a sense, first of all, who Yosef was. And that with the privity of their father. Their father agreed. Because this is a father who's willing, because their son had spent too much money, to have the son killed. For he was angry at him for the large sum of money that he had bestowed for presents, and so had no concern for his preservation. However, Joseph, this is Yosef ben Tovia, concealed the anger he had at his son out of fear of the king. And when Hyrcanus' brethren came to fight him, he slew many of others of those that were with them, as also two of his brethren themselves. Notice he defended himself. But the rest of them escaped to Yerushalayim to their father. But when Hyrcanus came to the city, where nobody would receive him, he was afraid for himself, retired beyond the river Jordan, and there abode. What? These were his real brothers. I guess if they would make this a motion picture, I guess the background would be singing, Hine Matoigo Manoyam Shevasgam Achamim Yochad, it takes us now, Josephus takes us now, and we're going to come back to this, this is very important, on page 2, paragraph D. But upon the death of Joseph, in other words, Hyrcanus had already decided he couldn't live there and removed himself to the other side of the Jordan. Upon the death of Joseph, the people grew seditious. In other words, that there was some sort of rebellion on account of his sons. In other words, when Joseph died already, Hyrcanus attempted again to go back to Jerusalem. He couldn't do so while his father was alive and the prestige of his father. As we have a sense of what the brothers were besides just cutthroats, they were very uncouth. You see that when they made the birthday party for Ptolemy, for Ptolemy's son, that the older sons were not able to go because they didn't have evidently the polish and the education to handle themselves well at the table of the king. Probably Hyrcanus felt when his father died and his prestige with him that he would be able to handle himself well against his brothers. But for whereas the elders made war against Hyrcanus, who was the youngest of Joseph's sons, the multitude was divided. But the greater part joined with the elders in this war, as did Simon the high priest, by reason he was of kin to them. As Rav Isaac Halevi points out, the idea that Simon the priest, and we're going to discuss him at length soon, was involved in this war and sided with the brothers tells us a lot about who the Simon the priest was. Basically, we're dealing with a group of cutthroats. Normally, you wouldn't see that... we don't have one, but you wouldn't see the chief rabbi, for instance, of New York siding with the New York family of the Gambinos against the Philadelphia family, the crime family. No, Rabbonim don't do these kinds of things, hopefully. That the high priest would side with them is indicative of what kind of a person the high priest was. Especially he sided with the brothers who went out to attack Hyrcanus, and Hyrcanus really only came to defend himself. Secondly, the reason given by reason he was kin of them doesn't seem to really hold water, because Hyrcanus was also kin. In fact, perhaps even more kin, because even Hyrcanus' mother was the daughter of the brother of Yosef ben Tovia. As was stated last time, Shimon HaTzadik had a son by the name of Chonio. Chonio had a sister whose son was this Yosef ben Tovia. So Yosef ben Tovia was a grandson of Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik's son, Chonio, had in turn another son by the name of Shimon. This is the Simon the high priest. This was a grandson of Shimon HaTzadik. It seems from this story that he himself wasn't much of a tzaddik. In fact, Rav Isaac Halevi theorizes that why Shimon HaTzadik got the title HaTzadik was because to differentiate him with the grandson who was not the tzaddik. Shimon HaTzadik's father's name was Chonio. So it was Chonio begat Shimon, who begat Chonio, who begat Shimon. If they were given aliyah to the Torah, both of them would be called Shimon ben Chonio. So they had the same name. The only way to differentiate between the two was to call the first one the tzaddik, versus the other one, who was not. And it seems clear from this we have a sense of what kind of person Shimon was, and therefore, in a sense, what the office of the priesthood had devolved into. However, Hyrcanus determined not to return to Yerushalayim anymore, as he had given up, but seated himself beyond Jordan and was at perpetual war with the Arabians, and slew many of them and took many of them captives. He also erected a strong castle and built it entirely of white stone to the very roof, and animals of prodigious magnitude engraven upon it. In essence, what had happened was that he, because that Shimon also had sided with the brothers, he felt now his father died, but still there was no hope for him to come back, made peace with the situation, and lived in grandeur on the other side of the Jordan. What we see now is basically that, as we see, the sons of Yosef ben Tovia were very powerful people. In the last lecture we explained that at the time Yosef had died, even much before that, the Egyptians had lost control over Palestine. It fell into the sphere of influence of Syria. And therefore, Yosef ben Tovia no longer was the tax collector. And he no longer had his old source of income. This is many years even before. Of course, this was after the first incident of Hyrcanus. But not many years afterwards, he actually lost that position. The power that he had at the time that this family had, let's say the crime family, even after the death of Yosef, is indicative that the monies that they had made, they put into other businesses, similar to the legitimate businesses that crime families, you have to diversify, so they diversified. In the next section, in section 2, we see would be a temporary turn of events. And we read in paragraph A, and this is Josephus, but up until now the quotes from Josephus have been from antiquities. This is basically a Jewish history from the beginning of creation till Josephus' times. The next quote is taken from the War of the Jews. This is, a great sedition fell among the men of Judea, the power in Judea. It's a very good point. If you go back on the timeline, we find, if you go back and you see, let's say on the Syrian list, you'll see on the year 187, Seleucus the IV was the king. By the year 175, Antiochus, this is the Antiochus of the Hanukkah story, became the king. The death of Joseph occurred shortly after the beginning of the reign of Seleucus. So we're dealing with the time period right now, this section, between the year 187 and the year 175, before the Common Era. And he says, a great sedition fell among the men of power in Judea, and they had a contention about obtaining the government, while each of those that were of dignity could not endure to be subject to their equals. Dignity, of course, in Josephus' thing, refers to their position of power. However, Onios, one of the high priests, got the better and cast the sons of Tobias, this Yosef ben Tovia, out of the city, who fled to Antiochus. And as we're going to see, there's a problem in terms of the dating here, but they eventually fled to Antiochus and besought him to make use of them for his leaders. There is a historical problem about this paragraph. Rav Isaac Halevi, however, understands this to mean, as we're going to see, the high priest that followed Simon was this Onios. Simon, it seems, was only
reigned in this position for a short period of high priest for a short period of time. As Josephus brings down the antiquities, Seleucus began his reign in 187, some years afterwards Joseph died and Chonio died. At that point, after Chonio died, Chonio, the son of Shimon HaTzadik, Chonio's son Shimon, the non-righteous Simon, became high priest. What we're describing now under the reign of Seleucus is Simon's son, who it seems to have been a quite righteous person. And when he took power, he made sure that those people were no longer in Yerushalayim, where it seems that his father, Simon, had sided with the sons of Tovio. Chonio had taken wanted none of this, and really sent them out. Because they had been cast out of power, they went to Antiochus. The problem here is just the dating, is that they actually went to Seleucus, who was it seems to have very positive relations with the former Yidden, with the non-criminal element. They really didn't have much of a say. When Antiochus came to power, and this is what we're going to see soon, Antiochus lent them a willing ear. But here we find Chonio, which just seems to be the Chonio that followed Shimon, who threw them out and really wanted to create a Yerushalayim similar to that before the days of Yosef ben Tovia. We have a very clear picture of what kind of a person this Chonio was. It's Onias in the Greek and Chonio in the Hebrew. And this goes, this is on page 2, this paragraph B. And this is from the second book of Maccabees. When the holy city was inhabited in perfect peace, on page 2, and the laws were strictly observed, because of the piety of Onias the high priest and his hatred of wickedness, it came to pass that even the kings themselves did honor to the place and glorify the temple with most noble gifts, so that even Seleucus, king of Asia, from his own revenues provided all the expense of the sacrificial service. So we have a picture now of Onias, who has already taken control of the city and has raised it to new spiritual heights. But of course it's understandable that even if he would throw out the sons of Tobias, the sons of Yosef ben Tovia, there would be holdovers. I mean, this is all an infrastructure, something which takes years to root out and replace. And one of the people that was firmly in place but had great sympathies with the B'nai Tovia was a man by the name of Simon, not from the high priest, but a man named Simon of the tribe of Benjamin, who had been appointed governor to the temple. He was a gizbor. Normally, by the way, as we see in the Mishnah and Shkolim, that the these positions were normally held by priests. The fact is that this man of Benjamin had this position was probably indicative of his close relations with the B'nai Tovia, with the, what we call the people in power, or used to be in power. Now, he had a difference with the high priest about the conduct of the city market. It's normally understood that this Simon, besides having influence in the temple, had a position to control the standards, the weights and measures of the city market. And it seems to have been a very powerful position, because he supervised the equivalent of the agriculture department here. And of course, the person who could be bought out, it'd be quite an alternate sense of source of revenue for a person who knew how to use his office in the right way.
And it seems that the Diaconia demanded a higher standard than this Simon was. I mean, it's really like trying to get rid of the mafia, which Italy is having just such a hard time doing right now. When he failed to carry his point against Onias, he went to Apollonius of Tarsus, who at that time was a governor of Coelesyria in Phoenicia. He was really a person who was second to the king, and reported to him that the treasury in Jerusalem was full of such untold quantities of money that the amount of funds was beyond computation. They did not belong to the account of the sacrifices. They might fall under the control of the king. In other words, he wanted to ingratiate himself to the king. Basically, he would already now be in touch with the real powers that be, and somehow be able to supplant Chonio as a real power in Yerushalayim. When Apollonius met the king, he informed of the money that had been pointed out to him, and he appointed Heliodorus, the king, who was his chancellor, and sent him with instructions to effect the removal of this money. Heliodorus immediately set out on his journey under the guise of visiting the towns of Coelesyria and Phoenicia, but in reality to carry out the king's design. When he reached Jerusalem, had been cordially welcomed by the high priest in the city, he laid before them the disclosure that had been made to him, saying why he had come, and inquired whether this was really true. The high priest pointed out that some deposits, really he declared that it was not true, that some deposits belonged to widows and orphans, and really it was under control of Bezdan of the Sanhedrin jointly with the high priest. This is really for social services. And one belonged, and this is a very important quote, to Hyrcanus, son of Tobias, a man of very high position. In other words, that Hyrcanus trusted this Chonio, the son of Simon who had thrown him out. But evidently he felt that the Hyrcanus was an Erlich Hayid, in other words, was a man of beyond reproach, and entrusted his monies, Hyrcanus' money, with Chonio. So the monies really were private funds. So falsely had the impious Simon spoken, that all amounted to 400 talents of silver and 200 of gold, and it was absolutely impossible that those who were relying on the sacredness of the place, on the sanctity and the inviolability of the temple, which was respected all over the world, should be wrong. Basically, says it's private funds, it's not public funds, and therefore the king really has no right to them. But Heliodorus, because of the royal orders he had received, said that anyway, this must be confiscated for the royal treasury. So he set a day and went to conduct an inspection of these funds, and there was no little distress all over the city. What the book of Maccabees, the second book of Maccabees, goes on to relate is when Heliodorus and his retinue came in, they saw an apparition of a man on horseback who attacked them. They were all chased away, and this Heliodorus, according to this account, was beaten furiously. In fact, there was fear that after they dragged his body out and he was still alive, that if he would die, they would blame it on Chonio and the Jews, and they prayed that he should recover. When he did recover, he had the greatest, at least this is the story in the second book of Maccabees, he had the greatest respect for Chonio and came back to the king, describing the incident and telling them that they should not in any way molest the Jews. And it goes on though, but this Simon, who had informed about the money and against his country, made accusations against Onias. Now, he didn't give up quickly, saying that he incited Heliodorus and had been the actual author of these troubles. In other words, the whole thing was a ruse, that he had that this was a there was no such apparition. It actually was people that were paid to harm this Heliodorus. He dared to charge with conspiracy against the government the benefactor of the city, referring to Onias, the protector of his countrymen, the champion of the laws. But when his enmity reached such a point that murders were committed by one of Simon's trusted men,
Onias became aware of the danger of their contention, and that Apollonius, the son of Menestheus, the governor of Coelesyria and Phoenicia, was increasing Simon's malice. Chonio basically was seeing that the Shimon was using every trick in the book to return to power. And he made a special appointment, the Chonio, to see the king. So he resorted to the king, not to be an accuser of his fellow citizens, but as looking for the welfare, public and private, of all people. For he saw that without the king's interest, it was impossible for the government to secure peace again, and that Simon would not abandon his folly. We go on in this third section. Yeah. The Maccabees II, in the introduction, writes that this was a shortened form of a five-volume work that had produced in the time of the Hashmonaic kings, describing the early years of the Maccabee revolt. And this is describes the incidents that led up to the revolt. So here we find, just summing where what we have, is we find the city originally, and the country and the outskirts, controlled by this band of Yosef ben Tovia and his sons, in consort with people of high office. And it seems that even after the death of this Yosef, he was supported, this band was supported by the high priest Shimon. It was only after the Shimon's death that Shimon's son Chonio wanted to bring the country back, in a sense, to its former position, and he encountered all kinds of resistance. Now, Josephus basically looks at the populace as the little people, as just little pawns. And the people that he focuses on are the people with money, people with power. But it would seem, as from other statements of Josephus, that the people were honest people, were honest law-abiding citizens, that sided with the high priest. But they were basically, they didn't have the power or the monies to do anything about the situation. It was only now that Chonio took position that he wanted to right what had been all these social ills. And we continue on to the third section here, also a quote from the second book of Maccabees, the ascension of the Hellenists. But when Seleucus departed this life, notice he came, this Chonio came to make an appointment with Seleucus to somehow influence him. By the time, you know how these government appointments work? Well, by the time he got in to see him, he had died. And when Seleucus departed this life, and Antiochus, who was called Epiphanes, succeeded to the kingdom, Onios's brother Jason, even though the Chonio himself was a tzaddik, it seems that he was an oisnam, he was unusual in the family. And he had another brother, Jason's Yoshua, obtained the high priesthood by corruption, promising the king in his petition 360 talents of silver and 80 talents from other revenues. Because this would be a yearly gift. As we said before, that the whole treasury in the base of me is just 400 talents of silver. Even if they depleted it, it would just be a year, enough for a year plus. Basically, what he would do would be renew the taxation that had already fallen to disuse. Besides this, he promised to pay 150 more, and this is a very critical statement, if he was given authority to set up a gymnasium and a training place for youth there, and to enroll the people of Jerusalem as the cities of Antioch. In other words, Jason wanted, this was Jason and others, felt that it was high time for them to throw off this patina of Jewishness that they had and to create in Yerushalayim an international center, so to speak. The Jews should live like Greeks. And he knew that he would encounter tremendous opposition. So the 150 more was not just monies to... He had to... This is Jason promised to pay this to the king because the king had to guarantee Jason protection that he would build this because the people themselves would never stand for it. I mean, it would just be... Imagine building a gymnasium in the middle... I mean, this kind of a gym, in other words, where they went without clothes, in the middle of Me'ah Shorim. I mean, it just basically that is what happened here. Yerushalayim was just one big Me'ah Shorim. Probably there was a section of the people who didn't, you know, the more assimilated Jews who didn't want to mix with them. This is the B'nai Tovia or others of that ilk. But the masses of people were basically from a Yidden. They looked like, they dressed like Jews. They spoke like Jews. They were learning Torah, I mean, to the extent that they could in the poverty. And yet here they were building this training. Basically, there would be a, you know, basically there would be, you know, the Victanis of Me'ah Shorim, you know. And everyone's coming in there and they had... So he needed money to make sure that he could get away with this. Because this Jason, if we would see who is the... List the villains of this story. Probably Jason would be high on the list. When the king consented, and he had taken office, because this is, remember, his brother had died, Antiochus just became king, and now Jason, there was a lot of change. Jason made this offer, and now Jason took office. He immediately brought his countrymen over to the Greek way of living. He set aside the royal ordinances, especially favoring the Jews. Now, the royal, especially favoring the Jews, means read the Frumme Yidden. Secured through John, this is Yochanan, the father of Eupolomius, who went on a mission to the Romans. In other words, Eupolomius was also a Frumme Yid, who was a member of the we would call the wider Maccabees. And who became an emissary to Rome, this John, the father, was also a person of diplomatic skills and had arranged special privileges for Frumme Yidden in Yerushalayim, vis-a-vis the government of Syria. And abrogating the lawful ways of living, he introduced new customs contrary to the law. For he willingly established a gymnasium right under the citadel. The citadel, as we see, was on the south of the Beis Hamikdash. There was a fortress, which we're going to see is going to play a prominent role. He made the finest of the young men wear the Greek hat. Evidently, the Greek hat had religious connotations as well. To such a pitch did the cultivation of Greek fashions and the coming in of foreign customs rise because of the excessive wickedness of this godless Jason, who was no high priest at all. This is the author here. And evidently, he was no high priest at all. It's an important point to realize. We tend to think of the Kohen Gadol as merely as a religious office. He was the one who went l'flai v'lefnim. He was the one who went to the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur. The high priest that they were vying for was not that of the religious office, but that of political office. And it's really doubtful that he really did much avoid in the Beis HaMikdash at all. I mean, if we see according to the level of his beliefs and his commitment. And because of him, that the priests were no longer earnest about the services of the altar, but disdaining the sanctuary, neglecting the sacrifices, they hurried to take part in the unlawful exercises in the wrestling school after the summons to the disc throwing. Regarding as worthless the things their forefathers valued, and thinking Greek standards the finest. So in reality, it was Jason who really introduced all of this. And when the quinquennial games, this is happening every 5 years, were being held at Tyre, and the king was present, the vile Jason, I mean, you have to realize from all these epithets here that the person who wrote Maccabees 2 was not very sympathetic to Jason. You haven't realized this yet. Sent envoys who were citizens of Antioch to represent Jerusalem to carry 300 silver drachmas for the sacrifice to Hercules. This is already a new step. Now basically, they were involved in Avodah Zorah as well. As one could say, it was just culture. This already had religious overtones. But even those who carried it thought it should not be used for a sacrifice, as it was not fitting, because it basically says, basically we see the anti-Semitism, at least this is how it's commonly understood. You know, they wouldn't take it from the Jews, but should be spent in some other way. So this money intended for its sender, by its sender for the sacrifice to Hercules, was applied because of those who carried it, and those out to fitting out triremes. Triremes are Greek boats that had three oarsmen on each side. And this basically was the fitting out boats. And they just took the money from the Jews. Maccabees 1, which is a parallel written by a different author about the events of the period, perhaps even a greater, it's less polemic and more of a non-passionate nature as a historical source, describes the events as follows. This is now on page 4, paragraph B. In those days there rose out of Israel lawless men who persuaded many, saying, "Let us go and make a pact with the heathen around. For ever since the time we become separated from them, many misfortunes have overtaken us." So this is just a new look. Basically, they're saying that our problems are that we're too Jewish. I mean, this is, we, everyone just knows our recent history. This saying has been echoed in our recent past as well. That our problems are we look too Jewish. If we'd be just more assimilated, they would like us all so much more. The plan seemed good in their eyes, and some of the people went eagerly to the king, as this is describing this story that we had in detail about Jason, but this was in terms of their motivation. So it really came again from those Jews who wanted to assimilate, and he authorized them to introduce the practices of the heathen. And they built a gymnasium in Jerusalem in the heathen fashion, and adding this interestingly, and submitted to uncircumcision. They looked, they pulled the skin over the place of their circumcision, so to look as if they had never had a circumcision, and disowned the holy covenant, the bris kodesh. They allied themselves with the heathen and became slaves of wrongdoing. This is how it's described in the first book of Maccabees. So we have, in a sense, we see, as the story goes around, that basically there was a group of Jews who were bent on assimilation and bought their way through the offices of the king the support to be able to carry this out. As you see in paragraph C is really just a rereading of what we read in Maccabees 1 in paragraph B. We have now, the story goes, it goes basically from bad to worse. As we read now on page 4, paragraph D, after the lapse of 3 years, Jason sent Menelaus, the brother of this Simon. This is how it's described. This is in the second book of Maccabees. Menelaus, who basically, if we would just pick one villain who would probably the most decisive play, this would be this Menelaus. And he is described as a brother of Simon, who was from the tribe of Benjamin, a non-Cohen at all, who was a friend of Jason. Josephus is in Antiquities, though, describes this Menelaus as a brother of Jason. To take the money to the king and to present papers relating to necessary business. But he, Menelaus, on being presented to the king, extolled him with such apparent authority that he obtained, in other words, he wined and dined him, and evidently Antiochus liked this Menelaus more than he liked Jason. And he obtained, Menelaus, the high priesthood for himself, outbidding Jason by 300 talents of silver. In other words, before Jason had bought this by paying 360 talents of silver, and he upped the ante, and now it was 660. Upon receiving the royal commission, he came back, possessing nothing that qualified him for the high priesthood. According to the version we have in the second book of Maccabees, he wasn't even a Kohen, because the high priesthood represented not a religious office, I said, but really it was a political office, with the passions of a savage tyrant and the rage of a wild beast. So Jason, who had supplanted his own brother, was supplanted by another and driven as a fugitive into the countries of the Ammonites. Eventually, the second book of Maccabees says that he wandered from country to country, and he died in a foreign land as Jason. So Menelaus held the office, but he did not pay any of the money he had promised to the king. Whereas Sostratus, the governor of the citadel, as we're going to see about the citadel, again, this was the south of the Beis HaMikdash, was a fortress. And there was a garrison of soldiers there that really were able to support, these foreign soldiers, support the assimilating efforts of Menelaus and Jason and his group. Demanded it, for it was his duty to collect the revenues. The two men were summoned by the king to appear before him on account of it. In other words, Menelaus said he's going to pay the money. This head of the Sostratus was supposed to be in charge to make sure Menelaus paid. And it came out that there was no money, you know, and he sent off a quick, you know, telegram, you know, with the geld. So Menelaus left his brother Lysimachus to act in his place in the high priesthood. And Sostratus left Kratos, the viceroy of Cyprus, to act in his. So basically we had a new Kohen Gadol temporarily, and a new general of this garrison. Now Menelaus did not have the money, but he thought he would be able to bribe his way into power. So he took Kalim from the Beis HaMikdash. So then Menelaus, thinking he had a favorable opening, presented Andronicus with some gold dishes from the temple, which he had appropriated. He had always sold others at Tyre and the neighboring towns. So it gives you a sense of who this Menelaus was. When Onios, you know, Onios, this is Chonio the Tzaddik, who had been pushed out of office, was certain of this, he sternly rebuked him. As he told Menelaus, I guess in no uncertain terms, after retiring to a place of sanctuary at Daphne near Antioch. Menelaus felt as long as Asconia was alive, he'd cause him only trouble. And he took this Andronicus, who was a man of a position there, and urged him to arrest Onios. And he actually killed him. He went to Onios, and having been persuaded to use treachery, offered him sworn pledges and gave him the right hand and persuaded him, notwithstanding his suspicions, to leave his sanctuary. So he somehow lured him out of his sanctuary and immediately, without regard to justice, put him in prison, and shortly afterwards he had him killed. What happened afterwards was, while Menelaus was absent, Lysimachus decided to go and to take, again, from the treasury of the Beis HaMikdash. He was not successful, though. You can look yourself, this is in paragraph F, that when he came, there was a whole uprising against him. People didn't have arms, even though Lysimachus came with a whole band of 3,000 men. But the people just came with sticks and threw dirt, but they overpowered these soldiers, put them to flight, and killed Lysimachus. They sent a group, the Frumoyidens sent a group to Antiochus about the theft. And charges against him about Lysimachus and Menelaus, and they sent them to Tyre, where the king was. However, Menelaus, through bribes, made sure that the king did not listen to them, and on the contrary, put the three emissaries from Yerushalayim to death. Shortly afterwards, of course, Menelaus went back to his position as high priest. As we said before, that Antiochus got to the position in the year 175 before the Common Era. Some 7 years after he took power, he went and waged war against Egypt. And while he was in Egypt, this is the beginning of paragraph G, there arose a false rumor that Antiochus had departed this life. And Jason saw now an opportunity. Now Antiochus was gone, at least according to this rumor. And Jason took fully 1,000 men and made a sudden attack upon the city. As the troops upon the walls gave way and the city was already virtually captured, Menelaus took refuge in the citadel. Because this was a fortress. Then Jason unsparingly slaughtered his fellow citizens. These were the people, Revised Halevi learns, these were the people, not only those who were partial to Menelaus, but these were the pious Jews, the Fumayidin, who have always resisted his position of power. Regardless of the fact that success gained over one's kindred is the greatest failure, and this is just philosophizing, and fancying that he was winning trophies from his enemies, not from his countrymen. He did not control the government, however, because it was really short-lived. Antiochus came up from Egypt and took over Yerushalayim, and in the end got only shame from his conspiracy and to take refuge again as a fugitive in the country of the Ammonites. But it wasn't just, the Jews did just not suffer from Jason's hand. And he says, King Antiochus is on page 6, returning out of Egypt for fear of the Romans. He was not able to conclude his victory, Antiochus, over the Egyptians, because the Romans, who were already a very powerful nation, who had already defeated the Syrians some years back, in the reign of Antiochus' father, Antiochus III, said that if they did anything more against the Egyptians, he would have to bear the wrath of the Romans. So he was in a very good mood. He made an expedition against the city of Jerusalem, and when he was there in the 143rd year of the kingdom of the Seleucidae, he took the city without fighting, those of his own party opening the gates to him. And when he had gotten possession of Jerusalem, he slew many of the opposite party. Now, this is all of Jason's men. And when he had plundered it of a great deal of money, he returned to Antioch. This is the capital of Antiochus' empire. So we find the basically all the city was, it changed hands from Menelaus to Jason, back to Menelaus, and in the interim, who knows how many thousands of people were killed. And it came to pass after 2 years of this incident, in the 145th year, on the 25th day of that month, which is by us called Kislev, and by the Macedonians Apuleius. This 25th day is the same day that Hanukkah came out some 3 years later. In the 153rd Olympiad, that the king came to Jerusalem and pretending peace, he got possession of the city by treachery, at which time he spared not so much as those that admitted him into it on account of the riches that lay in the temple, but led by his covetous inclination, for he saw there in it a great deal of gold, and many ornaments had been dedicated to it of very great value. In order to plunder its wealth, he ventured to break the league he had made. In other words, he had made a promise, willing not to touch the Beis HaMikdash. So he left the temple bare, took away the golden candlesticks, and this is we're going to see why next time, that at the victory of Hanukkah there was no menorah there. The Maccabees had to make a makeshift menorah because Antiochus had already taken out the menorah from the temple. And the golden altar of incense and the table of showbread, not abstained from even the veils, the proichas, which were made of fine linen and scarlet. He also emptied up its secret treasures. The secret treasures are understood. There's a mission in Shkolim that there was a separate tzedakah fund that was given in a that was put in a room that the people who put the money in did not see who the recipients were, and the recipients did not see who the donors were. It was basically a way to of an honorable way of granting them help. Those were known. This is this was called the Lishka Shel Hashoyim. This was the room of what we call it was secretive. And Rav Isaac Halevi explains that the secret treasury refers to this, really to this tzedakah fund. This is why he said he emptied even that, which is really was destined for the poor, and left nothing at all remaining. By these means cast the Jews into great lamentation, for forbade them to offer those daily sacrifices which they used to offer to Hashem according to the law. It was basically, at that point, the Beis HaMikdash ceased to function. And when he pillaged the whole city, some of the inhabitants he slew, and some he carried captive, together with their wives and children. So the multitude of those captives that were taken alive amounted to about 10,000. He also burnt down the finest buildings, and when he had overthrown the city walls, he built a citadel. Really, what he did was he refortified the citadel in the lower part of the city, for the place was high and overlooked the temple, on which account he fortified it with high walls and towers, and put in a garrison of Macedonians. As we said before, it already was occupied, but it became really a formidable place now. However, which is what we're going to see, which is crucial, I was going to say, as the story unfolds, in the citadel dwelt the impious and wicked part of the Jewish multitude, from whom it had proved that its citizens suffered many and sore calamities. It was really a city within a city, this fortress. I mean, it must be extremely large. And it was also a center of assimilated Jews. I mean, they lived as one with the non-Jews. And when the king had built an idol altar upon God's altar, and was on the bay, he slew swine upon it, and so offered a sacrifice, neither according to the law nor the Jewish religious worship in that country. And this now begins what Antiochus now was doing, was finalizing the process that already had begun under Jason and Menelaus, and made them build temples and raise idol altars in every city and village and offer swine upon them every day. He also commanded them not to circumcise their sons and threatened to punish any that should be found to have transgressed his injunctions. He also appointed overseers who should compel them to do what he commanded. The many Jews there were many who complied with the king's commands, either voluntarily out of fear of the penalty that was denounced by the best men and those of the noblest souls. Yeah, but the best men and those of the noblest souls did not regard him. But there was a considerable part of the populace that adopted idolatry. So here there was the group that originally all along were partial to this. And then we have a new group that, because of pressure, joined what would be called the most powerful. But this is the best men, the noblest, so did not regard him, but did pay a great respect to the customs of their country. That concern as to the punishment which he had threatened to disobedient, on which account that every day underwent great miseries and bitter torments. In other words, they suffered greatly to keep the Torah. For they were whipped with rods, and their bodies were torn to pieces, and they were crucified while they were still alive and breathed. Which is just an interesting point, and this is in Antiquities, that the idea of being crucified for one's belief is really something which had happened many, well over, that happened many, over well over 100 years, well over 150 years before the almost. You know, as a doctor, don't you know you take 2 tablets every day? The tablets were not in use during the whole Second Temple period, and actually were in hiding in a place which the whereabouts of that is really much discussion. Really, it's a whole shmuz by itself. In other words, there's a whole thing. Where, the whereabouts of the of those tablets.
What?
Yeah. They also strangled those women and their sons whom they circumcised, as the king had appointed, hanging their sons about their necks as they were upon the crosses. And if there were any sacred books of the law found, it was destroyed, and those with whom were found miserably perished also. The account that I read you from Antiquities, as you'll see, some paragraph I, is also repeated in the second book of Maccabees. There he gives just a greater account of what had happened in the temple itself, that they erected on the temple, on the Mizbeach, they erected an effigy, an idol of these, the Olympian Zeus. The temple itself was full of prostitution, and they had totally desecrated the temple. They stopped the keeping of Shabbos, which is a point which was not mentioned in Antiquities, or celebrate the festivals of the forefathers. We have, according to the Medrash, that the Hashmonoim were given that name because the word Hashmon, the Hasham, I guess, represents three crucial mitzvahs that the Greeks and their code and the Jewish and the Jewish Greeks tried to wipe out. The Ches is Chodesh, the idea of the Jewish calendar, and the creating of the Jewish calendar was really part of these of the festivals. The whole idea of a Jewish calendar they tried to wipe out. The Shin is Shabbos, and the Mem is Mila, circumcision. In paragraph I, this is towards the end of that, on page 7, we have, says this is around 5 lines from the bottom here, on paragraph I, others who had gathered in caves nearby to keep the seventh day in secret were betrayed to Philip. Philip became the governor of the city of Jerusalem, and all burned together because they had scruples about defending themselves. This is a fascinating incident. The people felt that it was really useless for them to defend themselves on Shabbos, because they would be killed in any case, so just be delaying their death. And basically they felt the end was coming, and they let themselves be killed and their respect and dignity of that most holy day. This is Eliezer, one of the leading scribes, a man of advanced age and fine appearance, was being forced to open his mouth and eat pork. He refused, and he was put to death. It seems that even though perhaps Antiochus felt that for the good of his kingdom, and perhaps this was his dream, to have a united kingdom, a united sense of worship, he would have never done this and never attempted to do so against the will of the populace. It was only because there was such a great number of people and powerful people that really wanted this and started implementing this on their own that he felt that it was the time was ripe to finish it off. Just to turn to page 9. Look at this. You can look at these quotes on your own. The situation was such. Now he says it to section 4. This is on paragraph A. Then the king's officers were forcing the people to give up their religion, came to the town of Modin to make them offer sacrifice. And many Israelites went to them, and Matthias Yo, Matthias and his sons gather together. Then the king's messengers answered and said to Matthias, "Yo, you are a leading man, great and distinguished in this town, surrounded with sons and brothers. Now be the first to come forward and carry out the king's command, as all the heathen met and the men of Judah, Yehuda, and those who are left in Yerushalayim have done." Basically, they're saying that the countryside as a whole had already succumbed. "And you and your sons will be counted amongst the friends of the kings, and you and your sons will be distinguished with presents of gold and silver and many royal commissions." With this, Montesio answered and said in a great and loud voice, "If all the heathen in the king's dominion listen to him and forsake each of them the religion of his forefathers," as he was trying to unite them to all one religion, "and to choose to follow his commands instead, yet I and my sons and my brothers will live in accordance with the agreement of our forefathers. God forbid that we should abandon the law and the ordinances. We will not listen to the message of the king and depart from our religion to the right hand or to the left." As he ceased to utter these words, a Jew went up before the eyes of all of them to offer sacrifice as the king commanded on the altar of Modin. And Matisyo saw him, was filled with zeal, and his heart was stirred, and he was very properly roused to anger, and ran up and slaughtered him upon the altar. At the same time he killed the king's officer who was trying to compel them to sacrifice. He tore down the altar. Thus he showed his zeal for the law, just as Pinchas did to Zimri the Solu. Then Matisyo cried out in a loud voice in the town, said, "Let everybody who is zealous for the law and stands by the agreement come out after me." And he and his sons fled to the mountains, and they left all they possessed in the town. This was the beginning of the revolt. It goes on page 10, describing the incident that we had before about how the Jews were put to death and they didn't want to violate Shabbos, the Jews that were hiding. This is in the third paragraph here, in B. "And Matisyo and his friends learned of it, and they grieved bitterly over them, and said one to another, 'If we all do as our brothers have done, and refuse to fight against the heathen for our lives, what we believe is right, then it will soon destroy us from the face of the earth.' On that day they reached this decision: 'If anyone attacks us on the Sabbath day, let us fight against him, and not all die, as our brothers died in the hiding places.'" It would seem the idea that one is allowed to violate Shabbos to save a life, which would be a common thing in the life of a Jew, would seem to be part of the Torah Shebaal Peh. As we pointed out, it was by and large not forgotten. The Torah Shebaal Peh, up until the time of the Maccabees, was intact. And one wonders, in terms of what really happened and the considerations involved, of what Matisyo said. In other words, what novelty did he introduce about defending oneself? This is on Shabbos. In all probability, it would seem, as we said before, that the reason the Jews had not defended themselves was out of sense of futility. Well, doesn't make a difference anyway. The whole idea of being Mechal Shabbos, of desecrating Shabbos, is to save a life. But if the life is going to be terminated in any case, there's just no use. And what Simatas Yo made the point of is that if we fight, we will win. And therefore, it says that there's no reason to just let ourselves to be killed on Shabbos. "And Matisyo and his friends," in paragraph C, went about and tore down the altars and forcibly circumcised all the uncircumcised children that they had found within the limits of Israel. And you have to realize again, they forcibly circumcised. The Maccabees were not great pluralists. This was not a sense of, you know, you do your thing and I'll do mine. They had a very focused view of what the Torah is. And there's a chi of responsibility, kol yisrael reim ze lo ze, of one Jew on the other, and particularly when it comes to bris milah, which is a community responsibility.
when the parents are unwilling or unable to exercise their own responsibilities. He forcibly circumcised all the uncircumcised children that they had found within the limits of Israel. And these children may have been older children as well. And they drove the arrogant before them, and the work prospered in their hand. So they rescued the law from the hand of the heathen and their kings, and would not let the sinner triumph. And this, and with this, we'll conclude this this particular lecture. Yes, Hashem, the next lecture will go into detail of the revolt itself, and the victory, and the subsequent loss, as you will see.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.